Hello and welcome to the podcast of Tim Masso, Kyle Lindsay. This is the Four Wheel Dive. The drive and dive starts now. All right, Kyle, batter up. Tell me a little bit about the Cadillac XT5 you just drove, because I got to be honest, when I think Cadillac, I still think big cars, and I still think Escalades. So how does a midsize SUV measure up?
Yeah, I'm the same way. The one that I got to test out was actually pretty cool. It was a Sport Platinum with pretty much every option that Cadillac offers for that thing. And, you know, crossovers are becoming a dime a dozen. I think pretty much every manufacturer has at least, you know, 10 of different flavors and sizes and colors and all sorts of stuff. But the XT5, I think, really kind of stuck out as far as, you know, being something that's actually really fun to drive, really nice as far as, you know, the quality and the features and whatnot. And it was just pretty cool. Like, it honestly felt like a legitimate Cadillac product and not, you know, like a Me Too offering, like, you know, you would describe a lot of other crossovers being. But, you know, the one that I had, you know, really, really nice leather, had carbon fiber, like bronze tinted carbon fiber all through it, standard V6 engine, all wheel drive, you know, good power. I liked it a lot.
You know, I saw your video of this, and I was kind of impressed that it seemed like a lot of the touch points were actually leather wrapped, which yes. I wouldn't have expected.
That's part of the Platinum package. There's a lot of exclusive things with the Platinum, like you get a higher quality leather upholstery, suede headliner, Bose performance audio system, like so on and so forth. And the Sport package also takes it to another level. Like, one thing that I thought was pretty funny, first time I saw it, you have these huge Brembo brakes on the front of this midsize crossover with big old red calipers. Like, at first it almost looks out of place, but, you know, with the other Sport specific styling touches, it you know, it all works pretty well, and they stop fantastic, by the way.
You know, I'm happy to hear that, because for a lot of years, I kind of regretted the direction the SRX took, because I loved the original SRX, which was almost like a tall wagon version of the first CTS. That felt almost like a performance wagon, almost like an all-road made by Cadillac. Then the SRX became very, how to describe it? I don't know, kind of frumpy, like it wanted to be a Lexus RX. It seems like the truck you tested is getting back to that kind of driver's orientation of the first SRX.
Yeah, it actually has more room on the inside. They improved utilization of space for passengers and cargo and stuff. But at the same time, they trimmed the outside. So it's got a wider track, you know, longer wheelbase and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, helps with practicality and driving dynamics. But the overall footprint of it is a little smaller, which makes it look a little bit more athletic and trim than the SRX did.
Now, compared to something that's just dominant in the segment, like an Audi Q5, this is bigger, right? It's bigger, but it's in the same price range.
Yes, it's a little bit bigger. It has a good bit more cargo space, and it's priced right around the same, if I remember correctly, if not a little bit cheaper.
The one thing that really struck out as just crazy to me, maybe because I'm so used to these old Cadillac overhead valve, you know, V8s, was that the engine redlines over 7,000 and it makes its peak power at 6,750 or something crazy like that.
That's the only downside with the V6. I mean, I'm an old school guy, you know, no replacement for displacement, yada, yada, yada. I always like having a bigger motor. You know, the standard engine for the SRX is a 2-liter turbocharged 4-cylinder, which, if you look at the numbers and stuff, you know, it doesn't make as much power, but the power comes on quicker. And according to, you know, some other people that I've talked to that have had the chance to drive the 4-cylinder, they actually preferred it over the V6 just because of its, you know, quickness and a little bit better response, and you don't have to wind it out to oblivion to get full power. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. Like that vehicle just feels right with a V6. The sound, the startup, it feels right.
You know, this is like a saying with Cadillacs, always get the big engine. And I think this is like a case that always get the big engine.
Absolutely.
But for those who are interested, can you get the Sport Platinum with the Turbo 4 if you want the low-end grunt? You're just about commuting, low speeds, traffic. Okay.
No. The SRX is only available in three trim levels. You got the luxury, the premium luxury, and the sport. The sport comes standard with a V6 and all-wheel drive. The platinum package is just an optional, you know, fancy package. It's got the over-the-top stuff, but you can get that with the premium luxury also. So you can get a premium luxury platinum, sport, platinum. But if you want the four-cylinder, the luxury and premium luxury is the only option.
You see, I think it's a great kind of sweet spot because to me, the XT4 is too small. It's too light. It's too rattly. It's too cramped. It's not a Cadillac. Badge it as a Chevy, charge a lot less money, you're good. But as a Cadillac, it doesn't quite make it. Whereas with something like the XT6, you know, it's a nice enough truck. But I feel like once you start loading it up with options, you should really be thinking like certified pre-owned Escalade because that's now within reach.
Right.
The 5 is perfect because it feels big enough and luxurious enough to be a Cadillac, but I'm not spending so much money that I start to wonder what kind of a used Escalade I could get for that same money.
Absolutely.
All right. Lots going on in and around the Detroit Auto Show. Possibly the most headline-grabbing news, and I think it's probably showed up in more mainstream newspapers and magazines and nightly news broadcasts, but Ferrari's got its first SUV. I mean, first of all, yay or nay on the concept, and then we'll get into the car itself.
Eh? Is that good enough?
Yeah, that's fine. Like, personally, I feel like if you need a vehicle like this, first of all, Porsche Panamera or like Cayenne or Aston Martin DBX, Lamborghini, Bentley, Audi RS8, Porsche Cayenne Turbo GT, you've got so many options. And if you want a four-wheel drive Ferrari with a hatch, you've got the GTC4 Luso and the FF. Go out, buy a used one. Have a great time. Four seats and a hatch, you're good. People will buy it. Look, it's a Ferrari SUV. People will buy it for that reason alone.
But yeah, it's just like, you know, the Lamborghini Urus. I actually had the chance to drive one of those several years back, and that was legitimately a lot of fun. But at the same time, it also shares a lot of stuff with Audi. So, you know, like you were talking about a second ago, with the, what was it, the Q8, I think it is? Yeah. But one thing I'm actually looking forward to hopefully driving at some point is a Rolls-Royce Cullinan. I like those.
You know, I'm all about that. Because here's the thing, like the Ferrari is there for one reason. Ferrari's now a publicly traded company. They don't need any more cars. They can sell every car they make without ever offering a truck. This new thing is going to start at 400 grand. And they're selling a lot of Portofino M's and Romas. And their stockholders are seeing lower transaction prices as they make up their volume with these cheaper V8 cars. So now you have the V12 Pro Sangue, and it's going to bring that average transaction price back up. But if you're going to pay $400,000 or more for an ultra-luxury truck from a brand that gives up nothing to anyone, why not get a real truck that can do all the truck things and get the Rolls-Royce Cullinan?
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, you've driven it. I mean, have you driven it at this point?
Not the Rolls-Royce. I've driven the Lamborghini. I've driven the Bentley Bentayga. That's about it, I think. I've been out of it for a little while.
I drove a Cullinan in Dubai, of all places. It was the place. It wasn't as unique as you might anticipate because there was one in front of me and one behind me, but I'm getting ahead of myself here. It's unbelievably big. Like you look at it and it's so low and it sinks down on its air suspension when it's not moving, but it's over 211 inches long. This new Ferrari is 195.7, which means you don't have a lot of space and the back seats don't go down and it really can't go off-road. In a Cullinan, you can tow stuff, you can haul stuff, you can fold down the seats. They have power tailgate seats that pop out the back of the truck so you can tailgate in Rolls-Royce style at a Cowboys game.
That is so cool. And go
off-road. Yeah.
So it is legitimately the Rolls-Royce of SUVs.
To the point where you wonder why they even need the Phantom. So if you are a prosperous plutocrat and you're thinking like, what should I do? My Cayenne, you know, Turbo GT lease is up. What do I buy next? Well, if you don't want to slum it with the Urus Performante, which is only $260,000, and maybe you want to do more truck things like go overlanding or camping or tow your yacht, just get the Cullinan. It goes 0 to 60 in 4.7 seconds. It's got hundreds of horsepower, all-wheel drive. It runs a 13-second quarter mile, and it's the size of a house. You can get a better Ferrari than the Purosangue. I don't think you can get a better Rolls-Royce than the Cullinan.
That's so cool.
What a beast, too. And customization. Oh, my God, the customization. The headliner looks like the stars in the Rolls-Royce.
Have you ever seen how they do that?
I have never seen how it happens.
A while back, I had the chance to take a private tour through the Rolls-Royce plant and saw somebody hand inserting every single fiber optic in a Phantom's headliner. It was mind-boggling. My mind can't concentrate on something that minute for that long.
It's mental. And with, look, I know they have all sort of Scaglietti custom options with Ferrari, but nothing approaching what you get at Rolls-Royce. If you want wood on the dash to match the planking of your yacht, they will take a sample from your yacht and they will recreate it. They will do whatever you want. That starry headliner, they will recreate the stars in the night sky over your hometown the night you were born. Like things you never even imagined you could get.
See, I have people ask me, you know, going a little bit further, talking about Rolls-Royce, because they're just amazing. I have people ask me, like, you know, when you talk about the value proposition of vehicles, you know, everybody's either, you know, oh, that's too expensive, or, you know, that's too cheap, or whatever. Everybody's got an opinion on pricing and stuff. But Rolls-Royce is one of those rare brands in particular that I can say it's worth every single penny, because yes, you can go out and buy a used Rolls-Royce. They are available, you know, relatively available.
Yeah.
But the whole point of being able to buy a Rolls-Royce is the ordering process, is the custom specifications, what they call the bespoke design process. Having every single nook and cranny completely tailored to you personally sounds like an unbelievable dream for an enthusiast.
And I guarantee you, without any doubt, the sound system inside the Cullinan will blow the Ferrari off the Autostrada. Like, you're going fast enough in the Rolls-Royce. It's all the other stuff it can do. So if you ask me, do I want the Purosangue or the Cullinan? I don't know if I have the personal panache to pull off either one, but I want the Rolls-Royce for the way it's made. Okay. The Mustang, seventh generation Mustang, is it new and exciting enough? Because it seems to me that they took no chances, but they brought back a lot of what was popular.
I do like the customizable digital instrument cluster panel. You know, I'm a sucker for analog. I'm not going to lie. I like my gauges and all that kind of stuff, but I have really become a big fan of all of these digital dashboards. Some are executed better than others, obviously, but there are so many cool things you can do with this technology. Like, you can actually have a layout that looks like an old Fox body gauge cluster that's green, has the red accents, like the old Ford stuff. I love stuff like that. I don't know if it's because, you know, I'm 33 years old now and I'm getting nostalgic about stuff in the 80s, but
yeah, I agree with you. Everyone who's talked to me about this car has been like, you know, you can do a Fox body Mustang instrument cluster. Everyone talks about that. They don't want to talk about the dark horse. They don't want to talk about the fact that the 6-speed's coming back. It's all about that instrument cluster.
And how funny is that?
It's cool. I mean, I'll be honest, I don't mind the changes stylistically. You know, I guess this is the S650. It looks just as attractive to me as the S550. It's almost like Celine or Astida or a Roush got their hands on the last generation Mustang, and they made some changes to make it more aggressive. It's not offensive. It's not better or worse. That doesn't bother me.
It's just evolved. It's a little bit more chiseled. And with every new generation of vehicle, people are going to like it. People are going to hate it. People are going to be, eh. I mean, yeah. At the end of the day, it's just personal preference.
Like, the biggest Mustang redesign of my lifetime happened, I guess it was back in 2005, when the old, like, you know, circa 1995 design that had been modified with the new Edge design. I guess they call it the SN95. That was replaced by the S197, which was the first like retro styled Mustang. That was a huge change. New powertrains, new platform, new body, new interior. The Fox body was dead after two decades. That was a huge change. This is evolutionary, but given that the Camaro's going away and the Challenger's going away, this is going to outlive both of them. I'm happy this car still exists.
Absolutely.
So the Dark Horse, some fun stuff. If you're into performance and you want to get the most out of your seventh generation Mustang, the GT comes back and there's a performance pack. So quick review. With performance pack, you get the Torsen limited slip differential. You get the Brembo brakes. You get wider wheels, special tires, so you get rolling stock. And then if you get the GT with performance pack, you get brake cooling ducts, you get enhanced engine cooling, and an extra auxiliary engine oil cooler. Now, if you go for the Dark Horse, you get a bunch of other stuff. You get chassis upgrades. You got an engine that they're advertising as over 500 horsepower. So a standard GT right now with the Coyote makes 450. This is going to make over 500. So I'm guessing it's going to be pretty close with the roughly 526 that you got in the old GT350. And, you know, 6-speed manual transmission, it's a Tremec piece. There is a 10-speed automatic available. I'd probably avoid that if only for fun and resale value. You get everything that's in the performance pack on the GT with the Dark Horse, plus a couple of things like exclusive body trim, interior trim, and pretty soon the option to order the Carbon Revolution carbon fiber wheels. It's going to be priced somewhere between the GT350 and the Mach 1. And I'm thinking because the carbon wheels are going to be available and the power is going to be similar, it's going to be more like the GT350 in price and performance than it is like the Mach 1. But that's just me guessing. So we shall see. All right. GR Corolla, have you driven it yet? And if not, do you want to?
I have not. And yes, I do. It looks awesome.
Yeah, I gotta say, this is weird because I never expected that the next WRX STI would be made by Toyota, but that it is. Subaru canceled the STI, and somehow we wound up with Corolla that does the same thing.
Yeah, and I think the biggest issue they're going to have is trying to keep up with demand, because for a manufacturer to come out with an all-new hot hatch like this that is basically a clean sheet design, it's like, what?
Yeah, it's wild because if you look at the Honda Civic Type R, which has had a waiting list since before car waiting lists were a thing, like what, you know, that had a waiting list back in like 2018 and 2019, before the pandemic, before supply chains, before production was constrained. So you would think Toyota would be like, look, we've got a huge dealer network. We've got incredible brand equity. We've got people who've been dying for performance models since the 1990s. And we're going to launch the coolest product since the original A80 Supra. And, you know, look at what they anticipated with their EV. They said between the, you know, the Toyota and the Subaru version, which is the Solterra, we think we'll bring in 13,000 of them this year. And I'm thinking like Ford is willing to make 80, 90, 100,000 Mach-Es a year and they're selling out. You're going to bring in 13,000? I think you're right. They're going to underestimate the GR Corolla demand. And there's going to be like a 2-year wait list for it.
Well, you know, and other things that are kind of surprising, and I think we're going to see this a lot more over the next few years, especially with the drastic changes that seem to be happening in the automotive industry lately, as far as, you know, certain iconic nameplates going away and all this kind of stuff. We're going to see a lot of demand pick up, and I think some of these manufacturers are going to end up being like, oops. I mean, look at the Ford Maverick, for example. That's their new most affordable truck. They can't keep those in stock. They're still trying to keep up with 2022 orders, but apparently the 2023 order books have already closed as of like today or yesterday, which is just unreal. I mean, it's cool, but you know, then you have dealers trying to mark up the ones that they have in stock and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, there are so many cool things coming out. how in the world are people going to be able to get them?
I don't think they are. And I mean, just look at this. All of this high performance stuff that used to be a hard sell is now selling out. Just look at the send-off model for the Chrysler 300. The 300 has not been selling like its platform mates. It has not been selling like the Charger or the Challenger. They discontinued the SRT version, you know, midway through the 2010s. I think 2015 might have been the year they discontinued it. And they brought this car back. They said, we're going to make 2,000 of them with the 6.4 liter Hemi. We're going to offer them online. And this is a car that had been slow selling in its standard form. It sold out in 12 hours at 56 grand. They must be thinking, we could have charged another 10 grand and sold just as many. Or maybe we could have sold twice as many at the same price.
Did you read the fine print of that?
Oh, geez. What, a dealer markups to be determined?
Yeah, basically. Because I looked over to Crystal. I was like, I don't need, but I want. Can we just put our name down? But yeah, if you look at the fine print, it's like, dealers are, final pricing up to dealers and all this kind of stuff. So I hope to goodness, because I know most dealers out there nowadays are subject to it, but I hope people don't get sprung with surprise markups and stuff on this, because there's a lot of really cool special editions surrounding these iconic Mopars. We see all these special edition Chargers and Challengers that they're releasing for 2023, yeah, which is going to be the last year for those cars. I mean, the prices for the ones that are on the lot right now are already ridiculous. I can only imagine what this stuff is going to end up being. And it's really unfortunate, because it's supposed to be like a grand send-off. It's supposed to be, exciting. And
about the car, not the money,
Right. And it's just, we are living in one crazy time when it comes to trying to buy vehicles.
You know, the weird thing is all the cars we've talked about, the Ferrari Purosangue, the Chrysler 300C, the GR Corolla, like, they're going to be the retail prices, the dealer markups, and then what people sell them on bring a trailer for.
Yeah.
Like, that's the last stop, on the way to the end user, who will presumably put it in a bubble. I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense.
This is why you want to buy like cars from the 2010s that no one's interested in right now. Like, go out, find yourself the lowest mileage, clean, like BMW 7 Series Alpina from 2007, and just drive the wheels off of that, because no one knows it exists.
There you go.
Okay. So we got a lot going on. Speaking of cars that are perhaps a little bit older than that Alpina, this spurs a question. If that is a fun car, but not yet a classic, what is a classic car and what is a vintage car? And at what point does a car cross over? So how would you define this, Kyle? Because I went out and I looked at a couple of sources, but I've got my opinion and now you have yours.
I'm sure everybody has a differing opinion on this. For me, well, if we look at state regulations and stuff like that, like a lot of states will say, if it's over 20 years old or 25 years old or 30 years old, it's considered a quote classic. You can get like antique auto tags and stuff like that. And, there's all sorts of regulations with that. But, for me, for something to be a classic, I would probably, stay around the 30 year and older mark. For something to be vintage, I would say anything from like the 1930s up to, the 60s, somewhere around there, because, between the 60s and 70s, you had the muscle car era and whatnot. And, after that, you had the malaise era. But
we'll have a whole show on that for fans. We're going to do a whole show on that.
Absolutely. As far as antiques, I think they're kind of in their own category. Like, I've always thought about vehicles pre-1930s as antiques, which if any of you listening to this podcast haven't had a lot of experience with vehicles that old, they are a whole different ball game. Things are so much more mechanical. Like, a lot of things didn't even have hydraulic brakes. You had manual, like crank it down, because it's up to your hand or your foot to provide the extra assistance. But, you know, you had hand cranks for starters. And, you know, you go back as far as the Model T, you've got all, you know, spark advance and retard on a little lever and stuff like that. So I think antiques are stuff that you just might as well just put in a museum and appreciate them for what they are. In the 30s, going forward up to like the 40s and 50s, they got a little bit more advanced. And then, you know, all the stuff started going crazy in the 50s with post-war technology.
Oh, without a doubt. It's good that you mentioned all of that weird stuff that you have to worry about with old cars, like in the 20s and 30s. You know, you've got some cars in the early 20s that still don't have front brakes because they couldn't figure out how to keep the brake tension consistent when the wheels were turning. You've got manual spark advance on the steering wheel because they didn't know how to do, like, you know, vacuum operated or mechanical spark advance in the distributor. You know, you've got crazy stuff in a Model T where you actually have a hand throttle and then you shift with your foot, not the clutch. You shift the planetary with one of two pedals. You push one, it engages first. You push the other, it engages second, and they pop back and forth. I would agree, that's definitely antique. I was also gonna say, like, the threshold of classic has a couple of different definitions. And around the internet, like Auto Trader, it's a massive used car dealing platform, but it has a 1982 cutoff. So, you know, when I think about that, yeah, that really does seem to be a rare type of vehicle. I don't see a lot of pre-1982 cars driving around that aren't some sort of preserved classic or vintage car. So 1982 is how Auto Trader defines a classic. In my state of Pennsylvania, we have these classic and vintage registrations. My 2002 C5 Corvette is registered as a classic, which has to be 15 years or more. You can get it registered as vintage if it's 25 years or more. And there is a difference. Like, there is a difference in how the car gets inspected. My car only needs a safety inspection, not emissions. Once it's vintage, and a lot of states have definitions like this, once it's vintage, it doesn't need any kind of inspection. And if you get either one of those registrations, the registration is good for the life of the car, so you don't have to renew it. So that's how Pennsylvania IDs it. Do you know how they do it down in the Carolinas? Do they have a...
In North Carolina, if it's 25 years or older, I mean, it also depends on the county. Depending on the county population, you'll have emissions testing or not. In the county that I'm in, we don't. We have safety regardless if it's a 2023 or, you know, a 1999 or whatever. But once it's over 25 years old, it's safety regardless. Even if you're an emissions county, I might have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure. But once it's over 30 years old, there is no inspection. So like my 89 240SX, 89 S10, all that stuff, I just pay the registration every year and I don't have to take it. I don't have to have somebody come out and whatnot. But going off of what you were saying about inspections and stuff, North Carolina is a little bit weird when it comes to registering classic cars. I don't know the super fine details of it, but I know from experience purchasing classic cars out of state and having to register them in North Carolina, you have to have a License and Theft Bureau inspector come out and verify the VIN tags and all this stuff and all, you know, check this and that. And oh gosh, God forbid you don't have a title. I've dealt with that too. That's really
common on older cars.
Yes, it is. And North Carolina makes it very, very difficult.
So now if you want to find out how difficult it might be to register or insure a classic car in your state, there's a great article on Hagerty from July 18th, 2019, How Classic Car Friendly Is Your State? By Craig Fitzgerald. Highly recommended. Apparently the most classic car friendly state is Minnesota and the least friendly is Massachusetts, but I will let you peruse that at your discretion. I think going to the insurers like Hagerty and American Collectors is a good place to start. So let's see what Specialty Insurance has to say. Hagerty says that a classic is pre-1980 in general. But keep in mind, they will also insure newer cars because it is classic and specialty insurance. Now, American Collectors, which is where I insure my old Corvette, says classic is generally defined as more than 20 years old, so something like an early C5 Z06 or a W220 S-Class would qualify. But then they go and they throw me for a loop because I went to check on the wisdom of Wikipedia and see what it had to say. And it cited an article from American Collectors that cited completely different numbers. So right here, it says key differences between classic, antique, and vintage cars. And it says age. The first key difference between these types of vehicle is their age. They say a vintage car is manufactured between 1919 and 1930. An antique car manufactured 1975 or earlier. And a classic car manufactured 2000 or earlier, which is fascinating to me because I never quite broke it down so granular a fashion, but I guess so. So what I really want to know then is, what if the car was made before 2019? What do we call that? A horseless carriage?
I think they call those, I think that's actually a new category. They're just calling them collectors.
Oh, okay.
So if you think about like, the Ford GT and, like the hypercars are collectors regardless, but there's a lot of, every special edition, everyday models, like what we were talking about with the Chargers and Challengers and stuff, like they're almost building instant collectors. Like some of these cars are going to be driven on a daily basis, but a lot of them are going to be put away and we're going to see them 10 years later being offered up, being like, oh, special edition, the last of this and not the yada yada.
And the other thing that's interesting is with a super old car, sometimes you wonder if it's even road legal. Someone just recently sold a three-wheeled 1897 French Voiturette, and it was a tricycle car from the 19th century with one cylinder, and you basically steered it with a tiller. And I can't even figure out if you're allowed to drive this on the road.
That's hilarious. Well, apparently you can still ride horses down the road, so I mean, there's that.
It may not be legal in its native France, but I'm sure in some American state you'll be allowed to go crazy with that thing. Like here in Pennsylvania, you're allowed to use horses on the road with carriages. We have a big enough Amish population that if you have reflectors and lights and you meet all the motor vehicle laws that are applicable to a non-motorized vehicle, 1 horsepower, 2 horsepower, 3 horsepower is perfectly legal in Lancaster County.
That's so cool. I can only imagine. I can just picture one of those carriages with all the lights and stuff on it.
And believe me, if you're worried about automotive emissions, you don't want to be behind one of these things when they emit. And they So we got classic cars from American Collectors giving us examples. 1978 Camaro Z28, 1963 Mercedes 300 SL, 1971 Ford Mustang Mach 1. So what I'm kind of wondering is, if we're going to pick some of our favorite classics, why don't we talk about some classic cars we like? We're going to limit ourselves to cars that are 20 years old or more in deference to Haggerty. Well, let's talk about some of our favorites. What comes to mind?
Oh gosh, where do I start? Well, I mentioned in the last one, probably my all-time bucket list car would be a 59 Cadillac. I don't really care what body style, just a 59 Cadillac. But I mean, for me, the 50s, it's just all about the 50s.
I'm sort of with you on that. Like, I get the new 300C, and it's going to be a collectible car, and it's really cool and all. But for the price you're going to pay after the dealer markup, let's say it's going to be in like the 70s or 80s, which is not crazy. You could pay $70,000 to $80,000. That kind of money will buy you a real 300C or D from 1957 or 58. And that is the car that the new car is referencing. The front end style, the fender lines, the performance. That is what the new car hopes it will be in iconic status like 70 years from now. And you can get the original for that kind of money. So I think that would probably be my ultimate classic car, a 57 300C.
I think that sounds awesome. But the biggest problem, like we've talked about before, that what we're going to see over the next, several decades is, as much as they want to try to make an instant collectible now with all of the technology and the wiring and the computers and all of that stuff, they will never be as serviceable in the long term as something like the 56 Thunderbird that I've got sitting behind me. I mean, at the end of the day, if I can't buy parts for a Ford Y block motor, you can be sure I can swap another motor into it or something like that. I mean, there's, you know, you can just keep going and going and going, just with aftermarket. But once your main infotainment screen goes out and it's obsolete, oops.
What do you do if you have a 2003 BMW 7 Series with first generation iDrive and you've got this highly computerized car that uses machines that are not made anymore, that are not rebuildable, and which use a proprietary programming language that even their original manufacturer no longer remembers?
That's why they're so cheap to buy.
You see a lot of cars like that rolling around with like the back end dragging on the ground because the air suspension's blown out and they can't fix it for anything, you know, less than the value of the car, because the iDrive doesn't work. So the whole infotainment system is out. The console, you know, the whole instrument binnacle is one unserviceable module. So when you lose your speedometer, you also lose everything else from the clock to the odometer. Who knows how many miles is on the car? And in a state like Florida, where they don't have any inspections, like stuff like this is still on the road. So yeah, I mean, it's a nightmare of unserviceable modules. Take my Corvette. I got a post 2001 C5 because it doesn't use a Bosch ABS traction control system. Prior to, I think, 2002, so 97 to 2001, they used a system that controlled ABS and traction control from Robert Bosch, which is a huge German auto parts supplier. And you can't rebuild them. And Bosch has already said they will not be offering service replacement ones. They won't make the part anymore. So if this system goes dead, there's really no recourse. You find a broken car and you hope you can take the module out intact. I mean, you've got 3,200 pounds of Corvette that could be in mint condition except for this computer. And this turns the whole thing into a paperweight. It's a nightmare.
Oh, my goodness. I'm telling you what, the older I get, the more I want to sink my money into classics and vintage stuff, just for the serviceability of it. But, you know, there's also a lot of people that don't know how to work on their own cars and don't have the ability to keep, you know, do the required servicing and maintaining that, unfortunately, a lot of classic cars need. So, I mean, there's definitely a trade-off.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing. It can't be your everyday transportation. I don't think a classic car or a vintage car or an antique car, however we define them, should ever be your daily driver. It needs to be garaged. And like a lot of collector insurance companies will say, look, you got to say it's never going to be driven by a kid. It's going to be garaged. You know, you don't have any moving violations. Like you do have to jump through some hoops to qualify for this insurance. And the garage is a big one because nothing destroys a like pre-clear coat car faster than keeping it outside. It will age so fast. That's why you never buy a car out of a field unless it's like an Auburn Speedster, something so valuable that any restoration price is worth it.
And, you know, too, unless you, you know, we talked about resto-modding before, unless you buy a car that's been resto-modded, whether it be an LS or Ford motor or whatever, you know, like my 56 Ford Fairlane Crown Victoria, it's got the stock Y block. I think it's a 312, but it's got the Ford-O-Matic transmission, which is like a 2 or 3 speed, depending on how you want to classify it. So, you know, that's not really something you can drive on I-95 down to Florida. It's going to rev it to oblivion.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be realistic about these things and you know, pick your moments. If you're going to go on a road trip with a vintage car, plan ahead and pick the right car. The other thing, too, is that, like, I like cars from the 50s, 60s, and 70s because, for the most part, the worst thing you're going to run into is maybe a car that's got a lot of vacuum accessories. Like the 60s and 70s were the era of vacuum. Manifold vacuum was used to actuate everything from windshield wipers to window lifts to cruise control systems. Sometimes they were interacting with the air conditioner system, just a million different things. Vacuum to open up hideaway headlights. It was used all over the car, and it can be a pain in the butt chasing a vacuum leak, but at least its hoses, its gaskets, its seals, and its clamps, it can be repaired.
worst case scenario, just put a bunch of new hoses in it.
Yeah, you might have to do every hose and every attachment, but you'll eventually find it. So yeah, that's why I like cars like, you know, the 1967 Cadillac Eldorado. There is my classic slash antique car from the 60s. If I could just have one, that's probably it. Everything that was great about the Oldsmobile Toronado, but with the style of that knife-edged Cadillac Fleetwood body, oh my gosh, you've got that bent rear window that looks like it's plexiglass, but it's actual glass, a mile of hood, and it's cush like a Cadillac, but it handled like no other Cadillac. That car is the one for me.
Absolutely. I have a weird fascination for El Caminos.
Go for it.
So I kind of forgot about that. Jumping back to the 50s again, 59 El Camino, the original. But I also like the body style in the late 60s, early 70s, right in the peak of that muscle car era. It was like the best of both worlds. You had all that practicality and then, it's basically a two-door Malibu with a pickup bed and then put a four-speed in the floor and a big block and it's like, yeehaw.
Yeah, like an El Camino SS396 big block four speed with positive traction. And, you know, since we're not going to road trip in this thing, it may as well have like a 446 rear end and just rip, you know?
There you go.
You know, the thing I love about that Cadillac is that, you know, it's got so much stuff that went away as the platform aged. It was on the, you know, for our friends who maybe aren't into this sort of thing, it was called the GM E-body. It was shared between Oldsmobile, Buick, and Cadillac. Buick used it for the second generation Riviera. They went rear wheel drive, so conventional. Oldsmobile went front drive. Cadillac, which co-designed the system with Oldsmobile, launched a year after the Olds just to make sure it was reliable. Let Oldsmobile take the risk with the first year. But Cadillac used its own engine, the 429, to get that smoothness that comes with a Cadillac big block. And that was the last of the, I guess it wasn't a big block because it was the last of the original 1949 Cadillac overhead valve V8. And so you only got that in 67. The next year they went to the 472, which was a different generation, bigger, higher performance, yeah, but you lost that link to the first modern overhead valve V8 at Cadillac. The other thing people forget is that the 68 had a bigger engine with the 472, but it also had a taller axle ratio. And the hydromatic went from a switch pitch stator to a fixed pitch stator. So a lot of people think that the 67s and the 69 or the 68s, the 69s and the 70s are a lot quicker when in fact they're not because they pull a taller axle ratio and they don't get that switch pitch hydromatic that could multiply the torque more in first and second gear.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, so the 67 actually winds up being as quick in acceleration as the 400 horsepower, 500 cubic inch 1970. And of course, the 69 and the 70, they lost the hideaway headlights. So like a lot of the sex appeal of the car was gone. So give me the 67 and I'm happy. I got everything I want.
And then depending on who you talk to in the 70s, it just went all downhill from there.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest about 70s. We'll do a whole show on the 70s, but it's a weird era because you have cars that are like downsized. You've got your Pintos, your Pacers, your Vegas, and, your Gremlins. And then you've got the last of the huge land yachts, the Lincoln Continentals, the Marks, Imperials and Chryslers. You've got Cadillacs that are 225 inches long and have two doors. Like it got crazy. You had those huge cars and then you had like those downsized cars and you had them at the same time. And it was a very weird period.
Yeah, it's like, what was it? A 76 Cadillac offered a 500 cubic inch motor? Yeah. It was like an 8-liter V8 that made 180 horsepower and front wheel drive. That sounds horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. Like that was the year that everyone went out and bought the convertible because it was supposed to be the last year for the big American convertible. And I'll admit, I do like me some 1970s Eldorado convertible, but give me a 71 or a 72 back when they still made decent power. The compression ratio on the engine just dropped and dropped and dropped. And so, yeah, they made 190 horsepower by 1976, 500 cubic inch, an engine that made, like, at its peak, probably about 270 gross horsepower in 1970. but it had a nice torque. It made a good V8 burble. Like, if you just want to cruise to the ice cream shop, a 76 Eldorado convertible, Haggerty, please make this happen. American Collectors, please make this happen. That's a great car to have because you've got six seats in a convertible, and nothing gives you that today. So, yeah, you're going to be slow as hell. But if you're not in a hurry to get there, you'll get there in style.
I'll tell you what, one of the most wild things that I can just think of just popped in my head of the late 70s. Looking back at the El Camino, the Ford counterpart, the Ford Ranchero, that, that underwent so many changes between the late 60s and throughout the 70s. It went to the Ford LTD platform, and that car, in talking about excessive length, look up a 1977 Ford Ranchero GT. That is the definition of massive. Like, it's weird because it's, you know, yeah, it's a truck car and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, you know, I like me a good big car, but that thing is too big. It's crazy how long the hood is.
Oh, well, they started with big cars in the 70s. They made everything bigger. And then in like 73 and 74, along came 5 mile per hour bumpers. And you wound up with these cars that were like as long as modern, like extended wheelbase pickups. They were ridiculous, like front to back. And here's the other thing, like stylistically, I'm going off on a tangent. But one thing that big 70s cars had that even big cars today don't have, it's overhangs. You'd have a huge overhang in the front and the back.
Yep.
Like, yeah, you overhangs are dead. Like, you look, even at cars from the 90s, like I guess you could call a Jaguar XJ220 a classic car today. Because it was made from 92 to 94. And, you know, American Collectors, Haggerty, that meets the definition of even an antique. But the 220 had these huge overhangs. And you just don't see that on, like, your Paganis and your Koenigseggs and your Lamborghinis today. The wheels are right out to the back and the front.
It's all about maximizing the footprint of the vehicle. You know, at the end of the day, having a wide track and a stretched wheelbase leads to better driving dynamics, better ride quality, and all that kind of stuff. You know, there's, you know, so many pros and stuff. But at the same time, you know, everything's got to be trim and streamlined and new age and all that. And that's, overhangs are not new age.
No, they're not. They're not. They'll come back someday. Everything comes back eventually, but not yet. Speaking of vintage and antique cars, I guess cars from our birth years qualify. So I was born in 1984, which was a bad year for cars generally, but I've got some personal favorites. Kyle, why don't you fill me in on what was hip the year you were born, or at least what you'd love to revisit?
So I was born in 1989, and there were a lot of cool things happening in 89. Well, like I mentioned earlier, I've got a couple 89 vehicles that are not on purpose. I've got an 89 Nissan 240SX that is an extreme resto mod at this point, as is my 89 Chevrolet S10. It's also an extreme resto mod. I like resto modding. I used to have a 1989 Chevy K5 Blazer, which was awesome. It had a throttle body fuel injected 5.7, slow as can be, four-wheel drive, rusty as all get out, but it was a cool vehicle because you just can't buy stuff like that anymore. But, you know, looking historically on some of the things that were coming out around that time, you know, 1989 was the launch of Lexus. Toyota's luxury brand, for those who don't know. But in 1989, they launched with the LS400, which was the Lexus. That was the flagship car. And if you go back and look at the history and the development of that car, it is absolutely fascinating what they put that thing through to make sure it was the best of the best. It would topple the Mercedes S-Class and be reliable and offer more. And I mean, it's just amazing. But along with that, they launched the ES250, which is basically a fancied up Toyota Camry of the time. But, you know, at this, you know, Lexus launched with two vehicles. And now, you know, we see more recently Hyundai branching off with the Genesis brand, and they've got a whole bunch of vehicles now. You know, I digress. But, you know, one of the other things that I thought was pretty cool, you remember the Buick Riata?
Oh, my gosh. I love the Buick Riata. That was like the Buick counterpart to like the Cadillac Elante. When GM decided its premium divisions should get these special boutique convertibles, the Riata was like the answer. It was a coupe and a convertible, I think.
And but it was like, do you remember, Do you remember what the best part about that car was?
Was it the trip computer?
Yes.
Yes.
So I can't remember. I think so. The Buick Riata platform, when it was first introduced, was shared with the Cadillac Eldorado and the Oldsmobile Toronado. Of those three, the Toronado was my favorite, especially the Toronado Trofeo. It was beautiful, I thought. But they offered a CRT display or cathode ray tube. It's basically a mini tube television in the middle of the dashboard. So you had a full digital instrument cluster, which, you know, in the late 80s, everything was going digital. Digital was the thing. And, you know, the gauge cluster was super pretty, but this CRT display was the grandfather to today's touchscreens. So if you can imagine a tiny little TV in your dash that controlled the radio, the trip computer, a driver's information system, the climate control system, and probably some other stuff too. It was fascinating. But they didn't make it the entire production run either. I think they stopped it, and it was between like 88 and 91 that they offered it.
Yeah, it was kind of late availability on the Riata, and I remember it because I think I want to say the Oldsmobile Toronado at some point also offered it, but it was like for people who had grown up as kids in the 50s and they'd gone to the GM Motorama and they were told about like the kind of cars they would drive in, quote, the future, that cathode ray tube electronic control center was the realization of all that stuff they were told would be in the car of the future. And the funny thing is, you know, these weren't connected cars. So it's not like you had navigation and the telephone and, you know, satellite radio. You had stuff that was intrinsic to the car, like radio, climate control, a date reminder, a trip computer. You could program an overspeed alarm. And then in the era before, like onboard diagnostics and standardized, you know, test tools, you could go through all your trouble codes using this thing if you knew how to work it. So it was really cool, and it looked way sci-fi, but it probably did less than it appeared to do.
I've actually got a Riata review on my YouTube channel. I think it's a 1988. I can't remember. If you go to Saab Kyle 04 and type in Buick Riata review, I've got a pretty cool demo of one of those CRT displays. You definitely got to check it out.
And here's the big thing. The real breakthrough wasn't that they put like a mini TV in your dashboard. For me, the breakthrough was that the whole thing was like a fairly well-functioning touchscreen back in
the 80s. It really was.
I'm on board with that. I'm totally on board with Buick Riata. I think that might, it doesn't. I was going to say that might be like a common car we've got between us, but I don't think it was available in 84. I think it was late 80s.
Unfortunately not.
But for me, 1984, I really like a car that became controversial because GM got sued after promising that the 1976 Cadillac Eldorado would be the last great American convertible. And so in 1984, the Cadillac Eldorado, on a new platform for a new generation, launched with a convertible option. And everyone was pissy and angry because Cadillac sold 14,000 convertibles, a disproportionately high number, back in 1976. People thought these were going to be instant collectibles. They would pay for the kids' college. There's your retirement right there. They put them in bubbles back before anyone was thinking of like preserving cars as collectibles right out of the dealer. People were rolling these things into climate controlled garages. You know, 25, 30 years later, they were going to be there and they would be sold as, you know, the modern day Duesenberg, the thing no one could get. And of course, in 1984, Cadillac comes out and offers a new convertible. And shortly thereafter, the Buick Riviera becomes available with the convertible top because it was built on the same platform. It's slow as hell, but it's cush and it's very American. And I would like to drive one of those. Not going anywhere fast, but you're definitely going there in style. And you're probably having fun.
And they're so different, too, between 76 and 84. 76 was, you know, it was the last of the big bodies. Yeah, the 84 was more streamlined and stuff. They were both front wheel drive, right?
I think, yeah, they were both front wheel drive, or at the very least, the 76 was. It might be that the Eldorado reverted to rear wheel drive for that one generation. I think that was the generation of Eldorado, if you remember, that Robert De Niro got blown up in Casino. There was that one scene where he got blown up and they're like, Well, that particular generation of Cadillac Eldorado had a big metal plate under the driver's seat. And it was there was some weird harmonic that the engineers couldn't fix, so they put a big plate under the driver's seat. And so that thing from the movie that saved him from the car bomb, that really did exist. And I think this car had it.
Wow.
Yeah, so this car was maybe not a distinguished generation of Cadillac or Eldorado, but it was definitely the best the early 80s had to offer. And I just checked, and you were absolutely correct. It was still a front-wheel drive car. I think the Eldo, if that generation was front-wheel drive, I think every generation from 67 to like 2002 and the end of the line was front-wheel drive. But there were other fun cars the year I was born. One of them was a genuine supercar, and like the only supercar I'm into. Like, I'm not into Testarossas. I wouldn't want a Countach. Like, it's just not me. I couldn't drive around in that thing with everyone staring and taking photos and, you know, wondering whether they want to rob me. And with the Audi Sport Quattro, you got all of the performance, and no one would have guessed that you were driving a supercar in this refrigerator-shaped thing with the wheelbase of like an airport like service cart. Like, this was the ultimate homologation special rally car. Audi wanted to go rallying. They wanted to do it with a turbo four-wheel drive with a chopped wheelbase. And so they made a couple of hundred of these. I think it was like 225. And it got a mad turbocharged five-cylinder. It had like real lockable differentials, four-wheel drive, like 86-inch wheelbase. And because it was such a short wheelbase, high-powered car, with like 2.5 turns lock to lock, it was really intense. Like, these days, those are probably worth more than Testarossas, by a mile worth more than Testarossas, maybe even to the point that they would rival Countaches. But back in 1984, you couldn't get them in the US. You had to buy them in Europe, Japan, you had to get them overseas and gray market them. A company called Bauer actually built the body. And a lot of the body was actually made of Kevlar, which was a pretty cool thing, you know, for the 80s, before carbon fiber. So, like, the ultimate supercar experience for me was probably going to be that Audi Sport Quattro. And they're still wild today. Even today, that car feels fast.
So something else that was pretty surprising, you know, looking back at, let's say, my era, the 1989 Ford Taurus SHO. So, yeah. The Taurus, when it first came out in the 80s, was revolutionary for Ford. I mean, so many innovations with it, but at the end of the day, it was the everyman's car. You know, sedan, wagon, you know, it was family, commuter, you know, it was just everyday car. But the SHO in particular was a performance sedan, and it offered, I think it was sub $20,000 price. And it offered pretty much the best bang for the buck performance-wise for vehicles under $50,000 at the time. This thing had a special 220 horsepower V6, 24 valve. It could do 0 to 60 in 6.7 seconds and reach a top speed of 143 miles an hour with a standard manual transmission. This is a front-wheel drive family sedan. And when you look at it, unless you know what you're looking for, it doesn't look like anything special. It had some unique body, you know, body kit and stuff. And on the back bumper, it said SHO molded into it, but other than that, it was pretty unassuming, and that's pretty rad.
Oh, it's very rad. And if you have one of these in good shape, you will be a star at any Radwood show. Like, you pull up in this thing, you are the bomb. Like, it was cool because back in the day, first of all, the Taurus, in, you know, the old cars are light. That's just the way I'm going to put it. Old cars are really lightweight. So even though this was a big sedan, it only weighed like 3,300 pounds. And the engine was designed by Yamaha, so it redlined at 7,000 RPM, and you got a three-pedal manual. And it's, you know, it's like almost like an American Alfa Romeo. It's not too powerful, but the excitement of driving it is like the full-time involvement of being responsible for everything the car does. The lightness, the sound, you know, just being in control. like people can't even imagine these days that you could accidentally over rev a car. Back then you hit the wrong gear slot, boom, there goes your engine. And you could do all that in a Taurus. It was crazy.
I know. I love it.
I am definitely down with that. You see, 1984 was a tough year for cars. It was like the low point for a lot of stuff. And even though the Corvette was all new that year, it had 205 horsepower, and it's just difficult to get really excited about that. But the good news is that was also the year that the Grand Wagoneer hit the market. And this was a car for which horsepower was an afterthought. This was the last great American station wagon, other than maybe like the Buick Roadmaster wagon of the 90s. This thing with its fake wood and its body-on-frame construction was a station wagon in like the 1950s paradigm. This, my grandpa would have thought this was really cool. And, you know, you got the big burbling AMC V8, so you're not going anywhere fast, but it's got the sound of a traditional American wagon. You've got this incredibly rich leather interior that feels like the American Land Rover. And even though it's running on like 2.5-decade-old AMC Jeep SJ underpinnings, you've got this commanding view of the road. It's weirdly liberating to be in one, because when you're in one of these old cars, all of the pillars are really thin. You've got this incredible view of the road ahead and the road alongside and whatever's behind. It's like you're in a greenhouse. Today, mostly because of crash requirements, pillars are super thick. You can't even see what's to the left or right of your fenders. In this thing, it's like you were floating along in a greenhouse with, like, you know, plants growing alongside. You had so much air and sky and light and visibility.
And nothing else like it.
Yeah. You know, you had that big, like, laterally hinged tailgate. It was just super cool. You had a full-sized spare, all of this neat stuff. And that was the year the Wagoneer became the Grand Wagoneer. And it was super cush. You got everything that was considered cool and luxe back then. You got air conditioning, you got cruise control, power windows, power seats, power mirrors. That was the bomb back then. There was nothing more you could possibly want. It had a cassette deck.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, those have become really collectible too. I mean, you can still find some for pretty decent money, but you can almost bank that it's going to have rust in some way, shape, or form, because they rusted pretty easily, unfortunately. But there's companies out there that will completely rebuild them from the ground up, like you just ordered it brand new from the dealership.
Yeah, and there are companies, I think Wagon Master is one of them, that will restore these things. They're not being restomodded, and I'm kind of happy about that. But Wagon Master, you know, is known for doing really nice nut and bolts on these body, you know, and frame restored separately, a frame off restoration. And, you know, these sell for $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. And frankly, I think that's money well spent. It'll never be worth less than what you pay. And there's never going to be anything else like it. Let's be honest. Today's Wagoneer, it's a little bit ugly. And, you know, there are a lot of other things like it. There are Escalades. There are Yukons. There are, you know, large products from the likes of Land Rover and Mercedes-Benz, like the GLS, and there are body-on-frame rivals like the Navigator. And, you know, it's just not as unique as it was back in the 80s. Because back in the 80s, almost everyone thought big 4x4 work truck. The Grand Wagoneer was a big 4x4 that was all about luxury. And it had all the capability of the work trucks, but it did what they couldn't do. It went to the golf course. It went to the yacht club. It went to the country club. It would take you up to the ski chalet. It was the rare American truck that was also cool to have in Europe. And it still is.
Yeah. There's so many things nowadays that are, you know, let's be honest. The Escalade, the Wagoneer, Grand Wagoneer, they're all very nice. But because of, you know, regulations, whatever you want to call efficiency or weight savings or whatever, safety, because of regulations, a lot of things are becoming more and more derivative. And as nice as things are, you know, when they pass you going down the road, you know, unless you're like a really big fan of a Grand Wagoneer or something, it's just like, oh, there's that.
And, you know, there's like the Toyota Sequoia. Like, everyone's got like a big luxury SUV today. Lexus has a version of the Sequoia. Like, at this point, the Wagoneer is like a bunch of other very competent, very expensive luxury, you know, full-size SUVs. Back in the 1980s, the only other thing that was anything like a Grand Wagoneer was like a Range Rover. And even then, you weren't going to get the same amount of interior space or that lovely square-jawed, hunkered American wagon look. The Range Rover was a different species. Like, it was capable and it was luxurious, but even though these things were comparable, you were either Camp Wagoneer or you were Camp Range Rover, and there was no cross-shopping.
We've got to do an episode on the 80s.
Yeah, we definitely will do. We'll do like a Radwood two-part. We'll do the 80s, and then we'll do the 90s. Kyle, where can they find us online?
I am SobKyle04 on YouTube and SobKyle04 LLC on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And I'm Tim_Masso on Instagram. That's Time Out, Tim Out, Kyle Out. Thanks for logging on.